McGill Daily, The Daily.
I'm McGill Daily.
Hi, I'm calling from the McGill Daily. Can I ask you some questions?
Is anyone using
this? This is a little bit problematic.
News.
Are you designed? Could I see you for a second?
We're going to cap this.
News, can you dummy?
Did that story come in yet?
Editorial is in 5 minutes.
McGill Daily.
Unfit to print.
You're listening to Unfit to Print, a McGill Daily and CKUT News collaboration. I'm your host, Chantal Schultz. Unfit to Print is a student-produced, bi-weekly show that brings the latest of McGill and Montreal news. Today's episode will feature an interview with Karen Tam, a Montreal-based artist who focuses on culture and community, whose mixed-media installation, Terra de Chine Curio Shop, is on display at Articule until October 2nd. The installation is full of chinoiserie, originally the imitation of Chinese art and motifs by European artists in the 18th century. Tam curated and created the chinoiserie in the installation. In the curio shop, jade, upon closer inspection, is actually soap, and porcelain is papier-mâché. On September 17th, Articule held a public discussion with Tam and professors Alice Ming Y. Jim and Kimberly Manning from Concordia University. I spoke with Tam before the discussion. After that, you'll hear an interview with Leila Sansour, who wrote, directed, and produced the documentary film Open Bethlehem, which screened at Montréal Arts Interculturel May this weekend. Open Bethlehem follows Leila for the last 10 years in her hometown of Bethlehem, Palestine, as she founded and worked on the Open Bethlehem campaign. The campaign's goal is to see a Bethlehem without the Israeli wall, a Bethlehem open to everyone. I interviewed Sansour after a screening and Q&A at May on September 18th. But first, headlines. The McGill administration released its draft policy against sexual violence on September 12th. The draft was written by Associate Provost, Policies, Procedures, and Equity, Angela Campbell, after the administration withdrew its support this past April for the previous sexual assault policy, which had been drafted over 3 years by an unpaid student-led working group. The current draft has been criticized for not being intersectional and lacking a section on supporting survivors and survivors' rights. On the website of the draft policy, there is a web form for students to share their feedback and concerns. The Student Society of McGill University, SMU, and the Postgraduate Student Society, PGSS, will also be holding focus groups for people to give feedback, especially those who have experienced sexual assault and those from marginalized communities. SMU Activities Night, where SMU clubs table to talk to potential new members, ran from September 6th to September 8th. All 3 days, Tangerine, a Canadian bank and subsidiary of Scotiabank, had an orange tent in the middle of the third floor ballroom that took up more space than had been allocated to them and made some students angry and uncomfortable. This comes with the corporatization of the Shatner building, shown by the new large advertisements for Uber, Tangerine, and Fido on the walls and floors of the building. SMU Legislative Council met for the first time in the 2016-17 school year on September 15th. At the meeting, SMU Alternative and Equitable Governance researcher Leslie Ann St. Amour presented a report providing recommendations for SMU to further commit to social justice and equity. These recommendations included creating an equity seat on the SMU Board of Directors and requiring equity training for all SMU Legislative Council members. All motions presented at Council passed. For more in-depth coverage of these stories and for other McGill and Montreal news, pick up a copy of the McGill Daily on stands now, or visit our website at mcgilldaily.com. Next is an interview with Karen Tam, an artist whose installation Terra de Chine Curio Shop is at Articule until October 2nd.
What inspired you to do Terra de Chine Curio Shop, and what was your idea in setting up the space?
Sure. The inspiration came from postcards that I found on eBay, which depicted the interiors of curio shop or curio emporiums in Chinatowns in the 1930s or so. And because I was, I think at the time, about 2011, thinking about fakes and copies and how to make my own copy of, say, like antiques. So it kind of came together of creating a space and environment which I could show a mix of these sculptures that I've made, my own fakes, as well as, you know, stuff that I sourced from stores and borrowed objects.
So in this exhibit, you use soap to look like porcelain, and I was also wondering where you find the fabric that you use to create the clothes and...
Right. So the fabric themselves, some of them I sourced in Hong Kong and in China when I was just kind of on holiday. Other ones, they're either given to me by my friends or my family friends, or else they're actually mine from when I was a kid. So it's like all the objects within the space, as I mentioned, they're either borrowed, but it's the ones that are mine. It's stuff that I've collected since since I was an undergrad, perhaps.
What kind of feedback have you gotten to this? Have you found that Chinese and East Asian viewers engage with it differently from those who aren't
right.
Chinese or East Asian?
So far, the reactions I've gotten were really range from, it's mostly positive, I should say, but they range from people just coming in knowing that it's an art space and perhaps knowing what the Arcticus space usually looks like. So they're surprised, I guess, at the transformation of the space. But then I also get a lot of, I guess, people who just come off the street because I also did an intervention with the windows. So it does look like a storefront. So that kind of draws people in. And once they're in, sometimes they'll actually wander through the space, pick up one of the few objects I haven't actually tethered, come up to the counter and, you know, ask how much is this or I'd like to pay. And then, you know, I explain that it resembles a shop.
So you talk about the idea of chinoiserie. I was wondering if you could define that first.
Sure. Chinoiserie was a style from the, I guess, 17th, 18th century, mostly. So it started in France, and then kind of was this mania. There was this mania or this fashion for chinoiserie that basically was an imitation of a European imagination or recreation of what Chinese or Asian art and decoration was like.
Do you think that still exists today?
Sure.
Right. So, given that it is kind of everywhere, what do you think the effect of chinoiserie is on cultural identity formation for the Chinese diaspora here in Canada and also in the US?
I think chinoiserie, there's the form where it can be detrimental. Maybe detrimental is a bit too strong of a word, but it could have a negative impact in the way that it may perpetuate stereotypes. But at the same time, sort of the use of chinoiserie where it can be, chinoiserie and the use of exotica both can be used as this tactic or strategy for either economic survival or a way of self-representation.
Right, because I feel like for first, second, third generation Chinese Canadians or Chinese Americans who may not be able to go to China or to sort of interface with what one might call like authentic Chinese artifacts, with like this is sort of what they only have access to.
Yeah.
So I just said authentic. We often see things as branded as like authentic Chinese restaurant or like authentic Chinese like artifact.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could speak to this idea of authenticity.
Sure.
Like who defines it?
Well, authenticity is quite loaded. I guess my work does look at authenticity, issues of authenticity and fakes. And I don't think that you can really say what's real, what's or what's truer. Or I should say, you can't really pinpoint what's the most genuine, say, the most genuine Chinese food or anything like that, because everything's always in flux and changing and developing. I kind of believe that sort of the ideas of using copies or looking at copies and sort of imitations as historical documents of a specific time and the attitudes of that time, if that makes sense in a way. So.
Yeah. Do you think chinoiserie has created this idea of a monolithic Chinese or East Asian cultural identity, and what do you think the implications are of this?
It can, and it has been used to kind of imply that it just covers, you know, all of Asia, and that there aren't all these separate sort of identities and different cultures, and I'm not too sure. I mean, I guess in a way that if one takes on a chinoiserie and to transform it, that's one way, I guess, of confronting certain aspects of chinoiserie that just bundle up everything into one.
Right. Who are some contemporary artists that you are in conversation with or who have influenced your work?
So some artists that I've been looking at recently are Francis Alice, a Belgian artist living in Mexico, in terms of how he uses social interactions or work within communities or collaboration to create an artwork, for example, or to address certain social issues. Other artists, say Doris Salcedo, for perhaps the materiality in her work and using sort of different materials and the way that she creates different works to look at social issues again and political issues.
I know in some of your other work you focus on the Chinese family restaurant, mm-hmm. And I was wondering whether you could speak to why you focus on that.
When I started the Chinese restaurant project, that's called, the whole series is called Gold Mountain Restaurant, it was, I guess, a reaction to finding out my parents were selling their restaurant. I grew up in one in the East End. They had it for, I forget, and I was like 24, 26 years. And it was, you know, typical kind of Chinese Canadian, non-authentic Chinese food. And in a way, it was one form of documenting sort of this history, in a way, our family history, but also, I think, not that I was trying to speak for, you know, other families, but reflect their experiences and looking at how, if you deconstruct and reconstruct the Chinese restaurant, what are certain motifs or elements that are always present, and why are they present? How are they used as markers of cultural identity or of a community? So.
I was curious what the reception to your work has been in China. I saw that you were in Chongqing for a while, and so I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Well, that's really, I was doing a residency for a month in Chongqing in 2010, and it was just a month. And so that's really my only experience showing or working in China. And it was purely a production residency. So there wasn't really an opportunity to show work except through an open house or open studio, I should say. And the work that I was doing there was more, was not installations. It was more sort of cutout works. So I think people were really interested in finding out how, what it was like to be a Canadian artist and how that worked, and you know, they were interested in finding out about the different art venues, the types of art venues, and so, yeah. So I'm not sure. I'd be interested to find out how my work is received there. So.
What do you think the importance of your work is here locally in Montreal?
I'm not sure. I don't know. Well, I shouldn't say I don't know. I haven't really thought about how my work, how it may be important here. Perhaps that I am reflecting the experience of someone who grew up here, who is not, whose family is from an immigrant family, and I guess shining a light on aspects of histories that may have been overlooked.
Great. Is there anything else that you would like to say about your work or your experience here at Articule? Or
I think it's been a while since I've shown in an artist run center in Montreal, and also for the past few years. So it's really nice. I really like working with or showing in an artist run center because there aren't sort of the certain aspects of exhibiting here is that you can just like show up, install yourself. You don't necessarily have to go through many people or if it was a bigger organization. And I love this space for this installation, the fact that it is a storefront. There's not many places that are like that. So I last showed this this installation in Peterborough at Art Space, another artist run center, but it also was a storefront. And the next place I'm showing it, Terra dos Chinos Curio Shop, is in St. Jerome at the museum there, which is definitely not a storefront. And what I'm hoping to do for subsequent showings of this work is similar to what I did with my restaurant installations, is to always add something different, add something new, that and continue to develop it. So for the St. Jerome, what I'm hoping that we can do is to actually construct a facade as the storefront within the exhibition space, because I'm hoping that people eventually realize that it isn't a store, that it is sort of in a way a stage set, or that it is a place that's false, not really trying to fool you into believing that it's real. So then hopefully by constructing it is to show that show it more apparent.
Great, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You just heard an interview with Karen Tam, a Montreal-based artist whose installation Terra des Chinos Curio Shop is on display at Articule until October 2nd, and then will move location. You can find out more at karentam.ca. We'll now hear an interview with Leila Sansour, director of the documentary Open Bethlehem and founder of the Open Bethlehem campaign. Could you talk about what Open Bethlehem, the project, and the film are?
Open Bethlehem is a project that I started together with several partners on the ground in Bethlehem in 2005. Israel started building a wall at the time. We knew for sure that the wall that Israel was building inside Bethlehem and around Bethlehem will have a detrimental effect on the future of the city and the future of its communities. It was part of, obviously, the larger wall that Israel is still building around Palestine. It's not complete yet. So at the time, I thought, and like many of us, were quite shocked by the prospects and the future of the city. And we wanted to start a campaign to try and stop the wall really in its tracks. Maybe we were a bit too ambitious at the time, because the wall sounded so senseless and such an atrocity. We thought we will be able to stop it. Surely people must be able to understand that this is, you know, not something that's going to resolve anybody's problems. So we started this campaign in 2005. At the same time, I was actually making a film about Bethlehem. My idea at the time was to document the building of the wall for a whole period of a whole year. And I come from Bethlehem, but I left it just after I finished school. When I left it, I thought Bethlehem was too small and too provincial and too restricting for me. I wanted a bigger experience, larger cities. I wanted to live in cosmopolitan cities. And when Israel started building the wall, I was working in the media. I was a filmmaker, and I thought that in the very least, I should document the building of the wall. And I was scared that such a major historical event could happen without it being documented. I intended to stay in Bethlehem for 1 year, but I started the campaign together with other people, and I felt I could not walk away after that. So one thing led to another, and 5 years on, I was still on the ground in Bethlehem, kind of trying to make sense of what my film is about, but also trying to push the campaign, which was an extremely difficult thing, because we kept struggling to reach out, to have the needed resources, and the wall was being built and becoming bigger and bigger and bigger and longer. And it's around after 5 years that I realized that as a filmmaker, you know, sometimes art projects influence life, and in my case, this particular art project ended up kind of turning my life upside down and changing it completely. So it slightly changed my perspective on where I stand and where the film is and what the story of the film is, but also I think it changed my perspective on what it needs to run a campaign on the scale that we thought. I realized that maybe I was naive. I mean, we all are at some point, and that we think that we can achieve a lot, but that many generations in Palestine, 3 generations have tried and tried, and my parents' generations have tried and didn't succeed. And just because I came with a couple of interesting or smart ideas doesn't mean that the change was going to happen easily. So it was, I think, a challenge to my ability to commit, and but also a challenge to how we perceive fighting social justice, because it's not a 1 year, normally it's never a 1 year process, or in fact it's often decades, and you have to accept that it's something that you have to do. You have to pace yourself, you have to be serious about how you're going to fight it, and how you're going to continue to bring energy to the table to see it through, to at least you know, make sure that in our case, that city like Bethlehem doesn't just perish. So all these big issues are issues that I have to grapple with all the time. And I hope, despite the fact that they are quite difficult, they're challenging, but that they'll make us all, and me, into a better person. So
the film spans 10 years. I was wondering if you could speak to the changes that you saw in the city. Of course, the wall, but just in general, what did you notice?
I think with any development, that such as the wall, every development that limits Bethlehem as a city, that makes it smaller than it is, smaller than it can be, and more dependent, less kind of sovereign, if you wish, does mean that people inside the city are more demoralized. There is less desire to stay among the young population. A lot of young people want to leave. And it is absolutely detrimental because we're talking about a city that has offered so much positive legacy for the region around it. It's an open city. Obviously because it's the site of the birth of Christ. But it's not only the site of the birth of Christ in the sense that, it's a pilgrimage place. It's a place that people come to and have come to for centuries, you know. But it's also a place that has had such a huge effect on the people living on the ground because it is the birthplace of Christ, because they're so open to the world, because everybody came there, because they've had these global connections with everybody. It did make for a city that has quite an interestingly kind of international outlook in many ways, being nevertheless a small village. And these kind of examples are so valuable today in the Middle East. I mean, we talk about the destruction of so many wonderful cities, and while Western countries try and bring democracies via every means other than trying to respect what is already there, the kind of structures and social heritage that we already have, that's so important to build these societies, wonderful things that we talk about. And nobody helps us preserve these examples and build on them. Instead, we see these examples being vandalized. In our case, it is by the Israeli wall, which is a country that's an ally to many Western countries. And so being an ally means it's a country that Western countries can influence hugely, should they wish to act. And it's a senseless development in a region that's already volatile. And we want to bring that understanding and the story to as many people as possible who could act with us to influence the situation and to try and campaign with us, to try and, in this instance, open Bethlehem, allow it to be a free city, and make that into an example or a promise, maybe. And I suppose for people who are fighting to preserve many other such hubs and examples across the Middle East, because if we can't really save any of them, and nobody can help us save any of them, I really don't see a good future in this region. So,
in the film, you mentioned that when looking for funding, there were limitations because donors would have an agenda that they would want you to follow, mm-hmm. being non-political. Could you speak more about that? Was it a major obstacle?
Yes. It's very difficult to be walking in the shoes of the weak. So to start with, your life is controlled, your economy is controlled, your borders are controlled. So you cannot really forge your own future, your own economy, for example, to stand on your feet, to decide how you want as a country and as a people to shape your lives. So we are in that position. And so we're very dependent. We become very dependent on international aid. Then international aid comes with agendas that are suitable for the countries that bring that aid. And sadly, in our case, people understand that the Israeli occupation of Palestine is apart from that it's wrong, people understand that it is not helping anybody move forward, any good things in the region and as a whole. It's a big challenge to international law, to the very foundations of international law. But there isn't enough desire or appetite to invest political capital to help the Palestinians. And therefore, most countries are very coy in what they support and what they don't support. In fact, because they don't want to throw themselves to try and end the occupation, they're not invested completely to try and help us do it. They mostly invest in things that basically kind of feel more like, I suppose, feeling good about trying to be helpful when you actually can't really, really administer the help and the decisive, bring about the decisive change that's needed. So I'd say that it's between providing a lot of plasters for the Palestinians, paying for that, and sometimes, you know, paying for everything other than removing the elephant in the room. I mean, we have a lot of support, say, for cultural things, which is okay, but, you know, in the end, maybe if we had our own economy, we would be able to support our own culture better. I mean, we don't have, like, our Minister of Culture does not have a budget, so we don't get any support for all our cultural projects other than through kind of crumbs that other countries throw at us, and it's not fair, so...
So you spoke to British Parliament and to some politicians in the US about Open Bethlehem. What was the reception like? And did mainstream political recognition change the campaign? Were politicians aware of the issue already, or were they just learning about it?
A lot of politicians are aware of the issue. And a lot of the people we spoke to were aware of the issues. I think it's a chicken and egg situation where politicians as well, we sometimes think that they can, if they understand, they can deliver what we need. And sometimes they can't because they're bound by the same forces in their own societies and political structures and power structures that do not allow them to move further and to advance causes that they even believe in. I mean, if you wish... when Obama came to power, one of the things that he did, he seemed to be trying to change the political discourse where he was almost influencing the grassroots so the grassroots can give him a bit more support and back to do some more work. So I think that formula is very common and it's a very normal formula in any political situation. So the people who we meet, often what they find in us and what they like in us is the fact that they feel that we are a good vehicle to speak, to mobilize further among the political establishment, because they feel maybe we speak a language that the political establishment does not get easily alienated by, that they can understand what we're asking for, that it doesn't contradict what they say they want to achieve. And I think this, also on our part, understanding that there's no magical thing that any one politician can offer us, and that it is a complex circle that we need to feed and need to build ourselves, you know, brick by brick, and bring people into the fold and bring larger commitment from them. It's an understanding, it's a very important understanding that anybody who's campaigning for anything, I think, needs to understand. I need to have the patience and the dedication to keep pushing at this door and keep transforming these political systems into networks and kind of blocks that connect together to push towards change. So.
Was there any story that resonated with you the most from people in Bethlehem when you were there? Like, for example, Khalil or...
Yeah. You mean from the film itself?
Or just from your experience, it's not necessarily from the film.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's nothing kind of magical about what I'm going to say. But I think for some reason, I think filming, for me, I don't know why, but filming old men who were really, really shaken. I mean, so shaken that they were either crying or that I could tell that their lives are completely devastated. Somehow was... the hardest for me to look at. I don't know why. I mean, maybe I think men are more vulnerable than women. I'm not sure, but they really always broke my heart. But also partly because I think the film, for me, was very much about reconnecting with my own father, who was no longer alive, and who dedicated so much of his life to serve Bethlehem and serve Palestine. Maybe... he was constantly kind of at the forefront of my mind, and maybe seeing old men being devastated was not easy thing for me to look at.
Where have you screened Open Bethlehem so far, and where do you plan to screen it in the future?
We screened Open Bethlehem most widely in the UK, partly because this is the country where I lived for a long time, apart from in Bethlehem. We screened it for, we toured with it for about a year and a half, and we put it in front of so many people and invited people in to become, to join our campaign, to become citizens of Bethlehem. The campaign developed a symbolic Bethlehem passport, which is an invitation for everybody to feel invested in the heritage of the city, which we believe belongs to everybody in the world. And it's an invitation to be a stakeholder in the future of this place and a player, the part of our network to secure the future of our city. So now we intend to take the film and campaign to North America. We're starting in Canada, and we hope to be coming back again and again. We're going to do it for at least 1 year. We hope to tour, and we hope to build a lot of new friendships. And we want to invite people to work with us, to screen the film further, so that we can spread the message and educate more people, and to invite them in again to become citizens and ambassadors of Bethlehem. So for the next 2 weeks, we're touring Canada, or we're having many screenings in Canada. I'm hoping to come back early December for more screenings in Canada. And then we have some screenings this year in America. Next year, I think we're going to have a bigger program.
For people who are interested and want to support your project, what would you say to them?
I think a lot of people would find it difficult to visit Bethlehem. Though this is the first thing I'd say, please visit Bethlehem. There's a sense of kind of a forbidding sense around Bethlehem, as though it's difficult to get to, or as though it's a closed place. But actually, it's a place I've always welcomed people, and it's the easiest place to visit, and I think it's very enjoyable to visit. Plus, I think if you want to understand much of the history of this region, also the political situation today, it's a wonderful place to be. It's a very compact city where you could see all of the workings of the occupation, all the relationship to Israel and Palestine, but also kind of the makeup, the texture of the social texture of societies in the Middle East. All that is there in a nutshell, if you wish. So I would encourage people to go, but I know that a lot of people won't. And for those, I hope that my film could give them a second pair of eyes. And so we want to try and screen the film as much as possible. And we are not a commercial film, so it is very much depends on people wanting to organize their own screenings. And so we encourage people to do so. Beyond that, we hope that people will consider becoming citizens of Bethlehem, and it's possible to do through our website. It's not very difficult to be a wonderful ambassador, and I think you can learn a lot quite quickly by just joining our network. And I hope that people will feel moved and inspired to do so, because it's not always that we are called upon and can be without a heavy price to pay, ambassadors and agents for change that is a positive change for the whole world. Of course, as a campaign, we remain very much in need for additional resources. And if there are any millionaires listening out there, they should get in touch with us.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You just heard an interview with Leila Sansour, director of the documentary Open Bethlehem, and founder of the Open Bethlehem campaign. To learn more, visit openbethlehem.org. That's all for this edition of Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. Make sure to tune in 2 weeks to hear our next episode, and in the meantime, check out our previous coverage and podcasts at mcgilldaily.com/podcast, or pick up a print copy on stands now.
Unfit to Print.